Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two segments today. First, Dimitri Holtzman will explain why South Africa's universities have become the scene of intense political confrontation. And at the bottom of the hour, Oddný Helgadóttir reviews the Icelandic political landscape after that country's recent election. Universities across South Africa have been the scene of vigorous and sometimes violent protests recently, as students demanding free tuition confront administrations and a government unwilling to grant it. Cops and security forces have been called in, and students have set fire to buildings and vehicles to make their point. The fight is symptomatic of the political problems of the country 22 years after the fall of apartheid. South Africa is more unequal than ever, the racial disparity is painfully stark, and the political class is widely seen as corrupt and unresponsive, and alienation and frustration are widespread. Here's Dimitri Holtzman, the former executive director of the Equal Education Law Center in South Africa, which litigates on behalf of the right to education in that country, to tell us more. What is going on in South African universities? I don't think there's been much coverage of this in the United States. It's been quite a scene of turmoil. Give us some idea of the scope and what's behind it.
Sure. I'll give you the short version initially. But basically, there's been a second round of student demonstrations, some of which has been quite chaotic since about the 20th of September this year. And in essence, what's happened is that, in fact, at some point up to about 16 of the universities across the country had either been shut down or partially disrupted by student demonstrations. And of the key demands of the students in relation to those uprisings has been the call for free education, firstly. And then secondly, attached to that is this idea that there needs to be a process of decolonization of the university and tertiary institutions in South Africa. So there's been a massive disruption to university classes. In fact, with some universities announcing that the classes would be suspended for the rest of the year. Of course, a massive effect on questions like how many students would actually be able to graduate at the end of this year. This whole impasse is basically in response to the government's most recent announcement that there's a recommendation for universities to cap the increase in fees for tuition for 2017 at 8%. And that was really what sparked off this kind of second round of student demonstrations, which in fact have their roots and history in demonstrations that started at about the same time last year and at about the same time when there was a similar recommendation made by the Minister of Higher Education. But in fact, the roots of the current demonstrations go back even further than that. Many people, I think, from abroad would probably be familiar with what's been known as the Roads Must Fall movement, which in fact began at the University of Cape Town in March last year. And really, the target of those demonstrations were the call to remove a statue at the University of Cape Town of Cecil John Rhodes. And in fact, so you know, we can speak a bit more about that, but that's really the origin of this most recent wave of student demonstrations, which have now been going on for more than a year. But the current call from the students is for free education, and in fact, for government to implement a strategy to achieve that almost immediately, at least from some sectors of the student movement.
What currently the fees like in South African universities? How high are they relative to people's incomes?
I don't actually have the exact statistics about that. But in fact, you know, perhaps to give a different angle to that question, speaking about some of the root causes and origins of the current student uprisings and student movement for Fees Must Fall. But of course, we can't really speak about that without looking into some of the broader social and political conditions in South Africa, both currently and historically. And one of the key features of that is really that, you know, South Africa, the rate of inequality, and then combined with that, the rate of unemployment has only grown since 1994, since the first democratic elections in 1994. And you've got a situation where, you know, 80% of the population is black, a vast majority of them coming from poor rural or township communities, who, in fact, as one of, I saw a recent tweet of some of the students, you know, mentioned the fact that 60% or more of public schools in South Africa, which the majority of black students attend, and that secondary school are free, and then are suddenly expected to pay quite exorbitant amounts, depending, of course, on which university it is that you attend, because the universities ultimately determine what the fee structure for tuition is going to be. And so you actually have vast disparities, also because of a government loan program and bursary scheme, which poor students are able to apply for, but which is massively underfunded and inadequate, in fact, for many of these students who, as I say, are in fact coming from, you know, making it to university, coming from quite abject poverty, having to overcome quite difficult economic and social circumstances.
I wasn't looking exactly for numbers so much as a sense of that the fees are a substantial obstacle to a large portion of the population.
Absolutely, absolutely. In fact, quite crippling in the sense that, you know, many students, if they're not able to get bursaries, are just simply not able to attend university. Those that are able to make it in are, as I said, of the poorest students, able to, most of them are generally able to apply for and access government-funded bursaries through the National Student Financial Aid Scheme. But as I say, many of those loans are in fact inadequate. And then, of course, that's compounded with the fact that the job market is so inaccessible to many of these students. You know, South Africa has one of the highest unemployment rates in the world. And so, yes, there are many major financial barriers to a vast majority of mostly black students attempting to attend and finish university.
What about the role of universities in South African society and the economy? Are they important as, you know, engines of growth where they are in advanced economies?
I would say that goes without question. You know, again, just to, I think, importantly remind ourselves of what the historical context of South Africa is, particularly from the lens of education itself. You know, under apartheid, education was one of the key tools of oppression and discrimination against black people that, you know, was entirely designed to train them and prepare them to be the cheap labor force that would prop up the apartheid government economically. And so, you know, in response to that, in fact, our constitution, which is world-renowned for a number of different reasons, but particularly because of its quite extensive and comprehensive inclusion of socioeconomic rights as justiciable rights in that Bill of Rights, I think is an acknowledgement of how central and important education all the way through to tertiary actually is when looking at questions around transformation of society. And so, I mean, back to the question, I think it goes without saying that both, of course, primary and tertiary education and secondary, but of course, tertiary education are going to be critical to undo some of the long-lasting legacies of the past and suppression, particularly of black people, that was designed and administered through the education system. It goes without saying that we can't fix inequalities, we can't address issues in the job market and unemployment rates if we aren't training and providing access to tertiary education for as many previously and currently disadvantaged, particularly black people in South Africa.
There's been an awful lot of violence surrounding these this movement and campus closures. How did we get to this point from this movement, which demands low or no fees, to a situation of such harsh confrontation?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's probably a number of factors. The first that I'd say is really important for us to acknowledge is that I think that there's been a certain degree of sensationalism in reporting on the student demonstrations from many of the media houses. And, you know, I think this applies whether we're talking about student demonstrations or anything else, that there tends to be a focus on the less of a focus on the peaceful demonstrations, on the attempts at negotiation, where that is led by the students, and more of a tendency to focus on, you know, perhaps even one or two violent disruptions that do happen. But that being said, there has indeed been a sharp increase in the violence from the demonstrators. But I think it's important to recognize that when this student movement, this current wave of student movement began around the Rhodes Must Fall demonstrations, where there was in fact a shutdown of campus, but all of that was done peacefully. And in fact, initially there was no call from the universities or direction from the state to bring the police in to quell, in essence, peaceful demonstrations. But in this, and in fact, the same occurred in the last time, but in the most recent disruptions to kind of daily and usual campus life that has been brought about by the student uprising has been responded to with violence, both by the state through the police, as well as private security firms, which were called in by certain of the universities, supposedly to protect university property and to try and bring order to the campuses, but that in fact, in many instances, were provocative towards the students. There was violence and brutality against the students, and I think that is a large reason as to why there was such a violent response from the students at many of the campuses across the country. From my perspective, of course, is not to say that that violence, even if it is in response to state violence and police brutality, should be condoned on the part of the students, because I think the movement has suffered a massive blow to the public support that they received in the initial waves of demonstrations and even in the current ones, which came up again in September this year. And unfortunately, there have been elements of criminality and violence in parts of the student ranks. I think that begs also a bigger and more important question, which perhaps the students in South Africa, and I think many people have employed a kind of consideration of the tactics and strategies that have been employed by them. But that there's a question about the way in which the student movement is going to seek to organize itself to be able to condemn those acts of violence and be able to distance themselves from it where it does happen. Because in my view, I don't think there is any utility or moral defensibility to some of the actions like burning down law libraries on certain campuses or buses, etc., even if that has been provoked by some kind of violent response from the state and private security.
Violence against the statue of Cecil Rhodes is one thing, but a library is another.
Exactly.
I'm speaking with Dimitri Holtzman, a lawyer and educational access activist from South Africa. Is this response from the state and the universities a characteristic of the way things are going in South Africa these days? The state does seem rather violently repressive.
Yes. I mean, although I guess this is probably not unique to South Africa, but I often find myself reflecting on the fact that, you know, there's no one perspective on any political event in South Africa, which I think can hold water all on its own, in the sense that it's always complicated. And, you know, even your question about, you know, where South Africa is going, I think it's always difficult to tell. Because on the one hand, we do have, I think if we look at this, the question around exorbitant university fees, there's been a complete failure on the state to respond proactively to the students' demands. It's often taken massive marches and weeks of unrest for there to be even the Minister of Education or ultimately even the President coming out to give a simple address or acknowledgement of what the students are calling for. And so there's been, I feel in my view, an abdication, and that's probably quite the most central point to this whole impasse and seemingly dead end that has been reached in this in the student calls and the response from the state, and then the sometimes difficult position that the universities have been placed in between the two, in a sense. And so, you know, on the one hand, I think South Africa, there are also other examples of South Africa and particularly the ruling party are becoming much more repressive and oppressive in response to resistance, either from opposition in civil society or even as we've seen a number of disturbing events happening in parliament and so in relation to opposition parties. And of course, you know, there was the massacre of striking miners in 2012 where, you know, on live television, 34 miners were massacred by the police following a protracted labor strike and labor dispute. And so there are these kind of really worrying elements of, I'd say, a decline of democratic principles, of respect for human rights, and of a state which is responsive to the people and also to its obligations in terms of the Constitution. And so there are these very worrying factors, but at the same time, I think there are also, you know, these key pillars of the South African story, which give us a little bit of hope in a sense. So, you know, we've still got a fairly robust and independent judiciary, although some of our other state institutions have, in fact, the term today in South Africa is, have been captured. So there's a report, for example, that was released today by the Public Protector, which is an independent constitutional body, about state capture and the idea that massive amounts of corruption have been happening at the highest levels of the state. And yet we've got a the report is only released today because of litigation and in essence an independent judiciary that was able to save some semblance of democracy and public participation in governance processes. So, I mean, that's a very long-winded way of saying that it's difficult to tell where things are going. For all we know, our president could be forced to resign next week or the weeks after that. Or, in fact, quite the opposite could happen, is that we could see a further descent into more chaos and violence if there isn't some kind of negotiation, an agreement that's able to be reached between the students, the state, and the universities.
You mentioned earlier that the South African Constitution reads very well on paper. How useful is it to social movements? Can they draw on legal structures to advance themselves, or is it just a lot of pretty words?
No, I mean, I think, of course, if left alone as such, the Constitution is simply ink on paper. But I think there are numerous examples of very difficult battles and complex issues which have been tackled by organized social movements of civil society groups, most notably in our 20 plus years of democracy, being the Treatment Action Campaign, as well as a social movement called Equal Education, which has been organizing around primary and secondary school or rights to education for learners in primary and secondary school. There have been many examples of the way in which social movements, where they are able to make or articulate their claims in terms of constitutional rights and make use of the judiciary, of parliamentary processes which protect and support engagement with the decision makers. There's been examples of many successful struggles waged by organized movements based on the law and the constitution which have been successful. But of course, these things take time, and the issues that we're talking about, whether it be student fees or access to university, whether it be basic labor rights or healthcare issues, I mean, there's a plethora of rights that are available in institutions which people can access. But sometimes these struggles take long. Of course, there's a big gap between the ideals and vision which is outlined by the Constitution and our current realities. And bridging that gap does take a level of patience and engagement with the way in which these processes of transformation happen. You know, some people would call me being too liberal in the sense that I believe that the best way in which these struggles on very complex and historically rooted issues like inequality, as it manifests itself in various ways in South Africa, need to be addressed incrementally rather than expecting us, for example, to be able to do away with university fees across the board overnight.
Well, it's not like there are vast amounts of money in South Africa the way there are in the United States. Sometimes you feel like if we just could unlock the bank accounts of the very rich here, we could have a much better society. But, you know, there's just so much poverty in South Africa. It's a totally different story.
Yeah, well, but at the same time, I think that there's still more to be done. I don't think that we need to deflect from quite an important question about what is it that we are actually investing in our education system. So to just tie back to, you know, your question about the Constitution and the rights framework that we have, there is in fact a strong argument to be made that the government, in relation to its administering and regulating of higher education, is failing in some of the most basic elements of its constitutional duties. And one of them does relate to funding of university education. There's not an endless supply of money, and our constitutional framework actually acknowledges that. So where the right to education, to higher or tertiary education is provided for in the constitution, that right is limited by the proviso that the state has an obligation to progressively realize that right within its available resources. But even if we look at what's happening in terms of state funding for higher education, that's in fact been on the decrease over the past number of years, and also is already lower than the average spent by governments on tertiary education across the continent. I think it still is an important question to look at how much money is being spent, where can we find more money to allocate towards tertiary education, as well as the fact that, you know, I was mentioning that there are other conditions in South Africa which also point to this question of the fiscal viability, for example, of free education. When people look and see that there are massive amounts of corruption where in many instances billions of dollars are being siphoned off of the economy and off the fiscus. And if at least as a starting point, there could be ways to plug those gaps and find ways to better direct the allocation of resources so that it can better support education in South Africa, I do think it's still an important argument to make. Of course, it's not the end of it. Just making sure that there's more money driven towards education won't necessarily or in itself solve the problems of inequality and in some instances, quite poor quality across the board.
And you also mentioned the decolonized education aspect of this movement. Could you talk some about that?
Sure. Some of the discussion is rooted in the kind of basic manifestations of the continued colonization of university spaces. So, and most obviously, that manifests itself through the colonial statues that we have at many of the university institutions that are still around today. You know, we spoke about the statue of Cecil John Rhodes, for example, at the University of Cape Town, which was successfully removed. But there are still a number of other residences which are named after colonialists, if you will, as well as a university called the Rhodes University, which people today refer to as the university currently known as Rhodes University. And so part of the decolonization element of this movement looks at that, looks at the way in which spaces give acknowledgement or reflect on the colonial history and the lack of, in fact, the lack of attempt in dismantling some of those figures of colonialism that still quite physically and obviously brood over university campuses and over society. But I think on a more complex level, you know, there are other questions about the way in which the project of decolonization still has a long way to go. If you look at, for example, I'll just give you some statistics on the enrollment rates at universities from a racial perspective, that, you know, statistics show that almost 60% of white students, which make up less than 20% of the population, get acceptance to higher education. 51% of Indians get access to higher education, whereas only about 14% of so-called colored students and 12% of black students have access to university education. And so that's in itself shows that there has been a failure to address some of the structural effects of colonization, of apartheid, and the failings of a kind of liberal constitutional democracy to address those to date in terms of just even access to university. There's similar claims around the composition of university academic staff, the racial composition of that, where there hasn't been sufficient and speedy enough transformation. And then more broadly, around questions of the curriculum of universities. And as an example of the critique of the need to decolonize university spaces, there being a call for African studies, for example, African-centered studies to be brought more to the center of curriculums in quote-unquote African universities, where if you want to take African studies, for example, as a curriculum choice, it's an alternative track method in the curriculum rather than being something around which the curriculum is centered. And so I think those are some of the articulations of this idea of the need to decolonize university spaces. But of course, I think with such a disparate and sometimes fractured movement, you'd get many different articulations of what that idea actually means.
That was Dimitri Holtzman, the former executive director of the Equal Education Law Center in South Africa, which litigates on behalf of the right to education in that country. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. That was some of Candidate by Joy Division, a choice inspired by this dreadful election season, though of questionable political relevance. Next, Iceland. On October 29th, voters in Iceland chose the 63 members of its parliament. A contrast with the U.S. is stark. They have one member of parliament per 5,000 citizens. In the U.S., we have one representative in the House per 750,000 citizens. Their turnout in the election was 73%. We'll probably turn out around 50. They have seven parties represented in parliament, rather more than our dominant two. Yet despite all that, Icelandic politics can seem almost as apolitical as ours. It's amazing how after a profound economic crisis, and Iceland was one of the hardest hit countries in the world, politics worldwide seemed so drained of politics. With some thoughts on that, here's Oddný Helgadóttir, a graduate student of political science at Brown, who's the author of a piece on the Monkey Cage blog on the Washington Post website on the election results. So let's start by talking about the Icelandic environment in general. How much has Iceland recovered from the economic crisis of years ago?
Wow, that's a good and very complicated question. If you look at sort of the general contours of the economy, they look quite good in many ways. There's hardly any unemployment. There's solid growth. And that is mostly due to a boom in tourism and also the fact that there's mackerel fishing that has come into the fisheries of Iceland recently. So it's these sort of coincidental things that have sort of served to push up the economy just at the right time for us. But then on the other hand, there's a lot of sort of deep problems that hurt people on a daily basis, especially to do with real estate prices. People can have a difficult time making ends meet nevertheless, even though the statistics look good.
And how did the recovery happen? Was it policy or good luck or, you know, the things you mentioned? Were you blessed by the stars or what?
I think there's still a sort of deeper story of the recovery that remains to be told. But I think it was a combination of those things that you were saying. One of the things was that we were lucky in part in timing that we were sort of one of the first countries to be hit quite hard. So there wasn't a stringent international policy in place yet. So we were treated quite leniently compared to many other countries. So we didn't have to do heavy upfront austerity as a number of countries that got into trouble a little bit later did. So we did backloaded rather than frontloaded austerity. We were allowed to put up capital controls, which played a very important role in sort of protecting the economy initially. And then also at the same time, the tourism boom in Iceland started, and that played a big role.
Okay, so now you had this election recently. There was a lot of sensational coverage, especially in the run-up to it, about how the Pirate Party was going to take over. So who is this Pirate Party to start with?
Well, the Pirate Party, it's actually an international movement, or a European movement, I should say, of parties that began in the mid-2000s, mostly centered on sort of cyber-libertarian issues to begin with, copyright, internet freedom, that kind of stuff. But then they sort of caught on a little bit in a handful of places after the crisis. Iceland was one of the places where they caught on quite a lot. They built up a sort of very interesting party in Iceland where they mobilized very democratically a grassroots of their party to sort of build a platform issue by issue. And it's done in a very transparent way. It's all mostly online. They got 5% in the 2013 elections and had three parliamentarians out of 63. Some projections showed them getting even more than possibly 40% of the vote, especially in the aftermath of the Panama Papers. But they wound up getting considerably less now, about 14.5%.
And has the Pirate Party itself grown beyond its cyber-libertarian roots, or is that still really what they're all about?
It definitely has grown beyond those roots. And there's actually an interesting story about this, which I didn't get to tell in the article that I wrote about this. You know, the Pirates had a very sort of clearly apolitical stance in the sense that they didn't want to define themselves on the left-right spectrum of politics from the outset, and that they sort of just go through whatever they want to make policy on issue by issue and bring a lot of evidence to bear and make policy that way. So they don't have a sort of, you know, ideological backlog that they're working with, as most parties do. And I think that gave them a lot of resonance in the current environment, which is basically sort of fairly disgusted with politics in general. So not being identified with any sort of recognizable element, I think, gave them a lot of momentum for a while. But then just before the election now, they actually came out with a very interesting initiative. So Iceland makes coalition governments usually. There's never been a party big enough to rule by itself. It's usually two or three parties that rule. And the negotiations usually happen after the elections, and they're usually sort of very opaque and behind closed doors, which a lot of people have often complained about, that you can be voting for a party that then works with someone that you don't agree with at all. And the Pirates actually came out and said, we want to make a coalition before the elections. And they suggested a group of parties to work with so that voters could know what they were getting. And the interesting thing here is that that sort of made them look, which I think is correct, relatively left-wing in some ways. And a lot of people think that that caused a lot of people to actually move away from them when they were somehow suddenly identifiable as something that people maybe didn't want to think of as what they were doing.
And then what about the other parties in the election, the more traditional left-right kinds of parties? Who is that cast of characters?
Well, there's two sort of traditional left parties since the 2000, basically. There's the Social Democratic Alliance, which was meant to be sort of, it was an initiative to sort of unite all the parties on the left to provide opposition against the historically very powerful Independence Party, which is on the right. And the Social Democratic Alliance, and that wasn't entirely successful because there was discord right from the outset. So that split into two parties, the Social Democratic Alliance and the Left Greens. And they have since then been sort of the two left-wing parties in Iceland. And the Social Democrats have, until now, usually been bigger than the Left Greens until the last couple of elections now. But that's actually a return to a sort of historical pattern, because Iceland has historically been quite unusual for the Scandinavian countries in the sense that the biggest left party has been the further left party than the Social Democrats. The Social Democrats have often been smaller than the further left, the socialists or the whatever you want to call them, depending on the historical period.
What about on the right?
On the right, there's been a sort of stronghold of the Independence Party, which is the right wing, since the independence of the country, which was in 44. They have more or less held on to 40% of the vote, with the exception of the immediate post-crisis. And one way of interpreting which I don't think is an entirely fair one, actually, of interpreting the current election, is to say that it's a return to their sort of historical share of the vote, because the Independence Party got 30% of the vote. And the Viðreisn Party, which is sort of one way of seeing who they are, is to say that they're a splinter group from the Independence Party. There's a lot of people that formerly worked for the Independence Party in that group, and they got about 10%. So if you put them together, that's 40% of the vote. But that's also not entirely fair, because a lot of the people that went to that 10% party actually came from the Social Democrats, it looks like. And the Social Democrats, meanwhile, were in a complete tailspin. They barely made it into parliament. So 8 years ago, they had more than 20% of the vote. Now they're just scraping into the parliament.
And what happened to the Left Greens?
The Left Greens did quite well. They got about 16%. They have a very sort of strong and charismatic leader who's very popular even among voters that don't support the Left Greens.
I think most Americans think of Iceland as being pretty much a traditional Scandinavian social democracy. Is that a fair characterization, or is it more complicated than that?
It's much more complicated than that, I think. I think it's more right-wing than those countries are that we tend to get lumped in with. Historically, the right-wing has been in power almost always. We had a left coalition in the aftermath of the financial meltdown, but that is the only left coalition that we've had since 44. That's purely of the left. And it's the only time they've gotten a majority vote of the share. So, you know, the state is really built up by a sort of center-right or right coalition, usually. But that's also a more complicated story, because it's a sort of right of a sort of moderate Christian democratic kind until the 90s.
Well, what's their social base?
Varied. That's the interesting thing as well. So they managed to have appeal that is not just class-based. I mean, there's certainly a class element to it, and I think probably, although I don't have the data to back this up, but I imagine that it's increasingly class-based, because there is a sort of emerging, I think, class tone in the register of how sort of the political discourse in Iceland now, which also has to do with a really rapidly increasing inequality. But historically, the Independence Party, also because it appeals to the idea of independence and sovereignty and all this stuff, which is very strong still in Iceland because we only became independent in the mid-20th century. And so they've managed to sort of broaden their appeal to groups which economically would not necessarily have been best served by voting for them.
Was the right government what was responsible for the financial deregulation that led to the bubble and the bust?
Yes, a center-right coalition.
Did they get punished? They got punished for that.
Well, not really.
No, how'd they get it?
There was, for many terms before the crisis, there was a center-right coalition in power. And then right when the crisis hit, just for a short while, there was a Social Democratic Independence Party coalition. So that was who was in power when the crisis hit. That government was ousted by popular protest, actually, in 2009. And it's in the elections that come after that that the Social Democrats and the Left Greens, for the first time, get a majority of the vote. And then in the 2013 elections, the center-right is returned to power.
And then came the Panama Papers, right, which upended?
Yeah, and the Panama Papers are also interesting because so there's these two parties, right? The Independence Party and the Progressive Party, which were the ruling coalition. And there were three ministers that showed up, Icelandic ministers that showed up in the Panama Papers, two of them from the Independence Party and one of them from the Progressive Party, who was also the prime minister. And he's the one that features in, you know, the video that got shown of a very embarrassing interview that got shown, I think, all over. Probably seen it, I guess. The way that this came up in Icelandic society was very dramatic because you know how this was kept, the information was kept very locked down by the journalists that were working on the story for months. And the way that it came out in Iceland was that the prime minister was asked to do an interview with, I believe it was a Swedish rather than a Danish journalist, who asked him about things like taxation and offshores and so on. And he said, you know, it's important for social democracies to tax efficiently and it's the basis of a just society and so on and so forth. And then immediately after that, he's asked about the offshore that that he used to own and that was transferred to his wife. And, you know, panics and fibs and runs off. It was in, you know, every, I think, NewsHour and also sort of a late night talk show because it was quite hilarious, if also tragic. So he resigned, which is very rare in Icelandic politics, actually. It takes basically something of this caliber for that to happen. He resigned, the government went on for a few months, and then this election was held basically in response to the Panama Papers. But the interesting thing here is that the Progressive Party, so he resigned, the Progressive Party, which is a former agrarian, now sort of a centrist, opportunist kingmaker, basically, they were punished heavily for this. I mean, they lost a lot of seats in the parliament, the prime minister resigned and so forth, but the Independence Party, who had two ministers in the Panama Papers, was not punished electorally. In fact, they gained a few seats. I think in many ways the winner of this election is the Independence Party.
And what do they stand for?
They are the, you know, they're right wing.
I'm speaking with Oddný Helgadóttir, a PhD candidate at Brown and author of a piece on the recent Icelandic elections on the Washington Post website. And then what about the new parties, the Pirates and, I can't pronounce it, Fjörsin?
Björtfrantir. So these new parties are all mostly new, and they're interesting in the sense that all three of them sort of disavow traditional political labels. The Pirates I've already talked about a little bit. The other two parties are quite similar in some ways. They both say that they're international in character, that they are liberal and, you know, humanistic.
Liberal, is that in the European sense of free market-ish?
It's ambiguous, actually, I think. And that's, I think, true of a lot of the sort of rhetoric that these parties use, is that it's pretty sloganeering or sort of, you know, it's hard to read any concrete policy meaning into a lot of it. One of them, I don't know if you've heard of the Best Party in Iceland, which was a sort of protest joke party that won the municipal elections a few years back. So there was a stand-up comedian that was the mayor of Reykjavik for a while. Did you hear about this?
No, I haven't heard about this.
Okay, well, he's a very sort of popular comedian, and it was initially like a protest joke candidacy. And then, and you know, their campaign promises were things like, you know, something for losers, a polar bear for the petting zoo, cocaine-free parliament by 2020. Like this kind of just, you know, nonsensical dada stuff. But then they actually won the elections, and he was mayor for a term. And this party, this sort of municipal party around him, which was called the Best Party, which was part of the joke, out of that was born a sort of serious political movement called the Bright Future Party, which moved to the national stage. And that's the Björt Framtíð. It's the Bright Future Party. So that's where they come from. They come, and it's, you know, a lot of sort of cultural and artistic kind of types that were initially the backbone of that party. But then, you know, they've come to take themselves to be, you know, a serious party. But again, they sort of don't want to take a clear stance in terms of their politics, hard to tell exactly what they're planning to do, and so on. But usually they are perceived as sort of maybe center-left-ish. And the other party, the Viðreisn Party, which means the Resurgence Party or the Resurrection Party, they're perceived as sort of center-right.
In your Washington Post piece, you say that despite all these pretensions of being beyond the left-right spectrum, that spectrum actually still holds considerable sway. What did you mean by that?
Well, I mean that the actual policies that you pursue have implications, and the implications are either what can be understood as left or right, you know? And there's no way around that. You can refuse to put the label on it. And I think, I mean, this is also a double-edged sword, because I think if you're a political party, you want to get power. And I think for all these three parties, the fact that they got as many votes as they did was in part due to their rejection of these sorts of political labels. But I think as a voter, it's important to still understand that, you know, actions have implications and they can be understood in this traditional framework.
Whether they like it or not.
Whether they like it or not. I completely see the rational reason to do it, because people like it. People like feeling like they're not left or right in Iceland.
So what kind of government is going to emerge out of this, you know, I don't know what to call it. It's first, you know, someone living in this preposterously bifurcated two-party system, to hear this multiplicity of parties that are very hard to classify, what kind of government will emerge from this election?
Yeah, there's a few options, and it's not clear yet. They're in the process of negotiating and talking right now. One option, which I think is in many ways the most likely, is a continuation of a right-wing government with the Independence Party as the controlling party, and with either the Viðreisn Party and the Progressive Party, or the Viðreisn and the Bright Future Party cooperating with them. If they cooperate with the Bright Future Party, it's a very small majority. They only have 32 of the 63 seats, which is a tough situation to be in, because it means that essentially any parliamentarian can hold the entire cabinet hostage. So that's less likely. Now, the sort of what throws a wrench into this is that the Viðreisn Party has said that they don't want to work with the Progressive Party. But I think that eventually they'll be able to say, listen, there's no other option that makes sense for us to build a coalition. That's one option, a continuation of the right wing. The other option would have been for the five parties that all the parties other than the Independence Party and the Progressive Party to cooperate together to form a government. That would be very difficult, because it would be a very broad coalition. And also now, actually, as things have played out in the last couple of days, it's also impossible, because the Social Democrats have announced that they're not going to be part of the government due to their poor performance. So that's out of the question. But then the Pirates did something interesting yesterday, which was to say that they would support a minority government of Viðreisn, the Left Greens, and Bright Future. And the Social Democrats have said that they would do that as well. So you could get a minority government of these three parties, which would be an easier thing to negotiate than a five-party coalition. So really, at the end of the day now, it's the Viðreisn, or the Resurrection Party, that has the power right now. So they have to put their cards on the table and say, do we want to cooperate to the left or to the right? And if you look at their profile, it looks like they'll go to the right, I think.
So what does this mean for policy generally?
Well, more of the same right now, which is more of the same of what we've been getting for the last 4 years. I mean, there's a lot of sort of very hot, important issues on the table right now. Some of it has to do with resources, most notably the fisheries. So one of the first things, or I think actually the first thing that this government that we've had for the past years did when they came to power was to lower the rents on the fisheries by a lot. So the state revenue from fisheries this year was less than half of what it was 4 years ago. And meanwhile, that industry is doing, it's making a killing. The profit and the dividends and everything is astronomical. Most of the parties on the left have been sort of taking a more, what should I say, a tougher stance on redistributing the rents from the fisheries more equally than has been done in this election cycle than I've seen before. So that's become much more of an issue. But if we have a continuation of this sort of coalition, then that probably won't change. So that's one thing. The other really important topic right now is healthcare. So we have a national healthcare system, which is good, used to be extremely good, but has been starved. It was actually starved even before the crisis, but then it really bore the brunt of the austerity of the after crisis. Even though the left government was in power, I mean, it's just they really had to make a lot of cuts, and most of them went to the healthcare system. And that hasn't changed now. And there's been a lot of sort of ideas floated about more privatization and maybe building private hospitals and so on and so forth. And I think where we're at right now, I mean, the strain on the system is just such that, you know, it's either it gets more funding or you will see things like that emerging, even though by far the majority of Icelanders don't want that. They all want, or most of them want a national healthcare system. So that's one thing. The other thing has to do also with the tourism. So I think part of what maybe played into the left Greens doing quite well in this election is that, you know, they have more of an environmentalist policy than the other parties and have had so consistently for a long time. And I think what has made that more of a hot topic issue now than often before is that you really see the sort of results of a lot of tourism without the needed infrastructure being in place. So there's a lot of wear and tear on, you know, very beautiful natural places in Iceland. And I think that has really sort of focused people's attention on environmental issues in a way that they weren't before. But the government that has been in power now has really done very little both to build up the infrastructure that's needed to make tourism sustainable and to sort of make sure that the rents are somehow collected in a rational and equitable way.
Despite all the varied political systems around the world, you know, ours versus yours, there's this common exhaustion with politics and frustration and alienation and just a real lack of ideological clarity. I mean, it's just the most remarkable thing. You know, despite all these different cultures and different political systems, you see this, you know, the Pirate Party or Donald Trump. I mean, it's, all these things are just, I don't know, it's a systemic exhaustion, popular alienation. It's just the most remarkable disconnect between thinking and acting in politics.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And I know more than most people, I think, have a good explanation for it. I mean, to me, it's very interesting that in Iceland, you have this very dominant sort of post-political discourse for all the new parties, when in fact, the sort of material conditions are such that you would imagine that they would be ideal for a very sort of typical left-wing politics to do well, but they don't. And I can't explain why.
I can't either. I was hoping you could. All right, thank you very much.
That was Oddný Helgadóttir, a graduate student of political science at Brown and author of a piece on the Icelandic elections on the Washington Post Monkey Cage blog. After this interview was recorded, the president of Iceland asked the Independence Party to form a government which will tilt to the right. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, another song called Candidate, this by David Bowie. Till next week, when we'll probably know who our next president is. Bye.
make you a deal. Like any other candidate, you'll pretend we're walking home, cause your future's at stake. My set is amazing, it even smells like a street. There's a bar at the end where I can meet you and your friend. Someone scrawled on the wall, I smell the blood of late tree cutters, wrote up scandals in other bars. I'm having so much fun with the poisonous people, spreading rumors and lies on stories they made up. Some make you sing and some make you scream. One makes you wish that you've never been seen. But there's a shop on the corner that's selling happy and shady, making bulletproof faces, Charlie Manson catches wind. If you want it, boys, better hear this. So you scream out of line, I want you, I need you. Anyone out there, anytime. Trick whistling number one, say dirty, I want you. When it's good, it's really good. And when it's bad, I go to pieces.